Gracious Heavenly Father, we come before you thirsty for knowledge. Knowledge of the truth. Knowledge flowing freely from the Word, your Word. Sanctify this place with your presence and enlighten our minds as we study the Word. For we pray in Christ's name. Amen. Now, my name, let's get that out of the way first. My name. There you have it. Angel Manuel Rodriguez. Now, this is the way we pronounce it in Spanish. You can call me Angel, that's fine. I feel good about that. For you have no idea what type of angel I am. You think I'm a good one, and that's fine. Keep it that way. But this is the way we pronounce it. Now that's bad, that's really bad. Because it tells you the type of angel I am. But it's really, you see, we put the stress here. So it's not Angel, but Angel. But you can call me Angel, you know, I feel good about that. My mother was wise, very wise. She gave me a name that is pleasing to the ear of the ladies. And my father said, we better give him that is pleasing to the ear of men. So he inserted their manual. And you can imagine both names can be mispronounced. Manuel could very easily become Manuel. And I don't want to be called Manuel. Angel, I've been called Angel. Angel. Angel, Angel, Angel. You know, all kind of things. It's fine with me. So you call me whatever you want. And I'll say, here I am. It's good to be here. Let me tell you what I'm doing. You may not know what I'm doing these days. I work with the Biblical Research Institute of the General Conference. I'm not sure that you know what the Biblical Research Institute is. Some of you may know. Not many people know that there is such a thing as a Biblical Research Institute in the building of the General Conference. So let me very briefly tell you what it is that we do. There are four Adventist theologians whose office is located in the building of the General Conference. And we have three main functions. Number one, we are consultants in the field of theology for church administrators at the GC and also throughout many of the divisions. If they have questions dealing with Adventist theology or theology in general, they consult with us and we provide answers for the questions. We write papers, short papers or long papers for them. We have many committees and commissions working at the General Conference building, and sometimes in the process of making decisions, they ask the Biblical Research Institute to write a paper for them on that particular subject. For instance, the most recent paper that I wrote was on a subject that I never thought I would ever write a paper on that subject. The committee was dealing with the issue of salaries. Remuneration, the remuneration system of the church. And somebody in the committee said, well, we should look at whatever the Bible has to say about that. And whatever Ellen G. White has to say about that, which is very good. I think it's a good idea. I mean, so the Ellen G. White paper was, somebody was asked from the Ellen G. White estate to write a paper, and the one on the Bible, the chief, my chief, George Reed, some of you may know him, he came to my desk and he said, this is what I want you to write. Remuneration, financial remuneration in the Bible. Where did you start? I mean, so I wrote the paper. Yes. was about 14 pages paper, and I sent it to the committee, and they used it for discussion among them and to try to get some valuable principles. So this is, you know, what I mean by consultants. And we do the same in many other committees. The second function is a nurturing function. We write materials that hopefully deepen the Adventist understanding of doctrines and concepts. We write most of them for pastors and Bible teachers. So that's why you don't see much up there, but it's mainly for pastors and lay people who are really interested. The most recent volume that we have produced two recent ones, but the most recent one is volume 12 of the SDA Bible Commentary. Have you seen that one? It's a new volume for the SDA Commentary. And it's called A Handbook of Seventh-day Adventist Theology. It's the first Adventist handbook, theological handbook, that the church has ever produced. You want to take a look at it? It's in there. The ABC has it there. Take a look at it. It takes each one of our doctrines and other concepts that we have and provides a careful biblical analysis of it, careful study of it. And it was written by about 25 Adventist theologians from around the world, coordinated by the Biblical Research Institute. And the third function is apologetics. We do apologetics. That is to say, we defend the church and its message from attacks from the outside and attacks from, I have to say it, from the inside. I mean, I'm sorry I have to say that, but it happens. You know it. So we are from the inside and from the outside, and we have to deal with that. Now, of course, four of us is not enough. We don't know everything. I would like to know everything, but I don't. The more I learn, the more ignorant I become. I tell my wife that one of these days I'm going to be permanently mute, having nothing to say, you know, because there is so much out there that whatever you say is insignificant. So we have a committee. We call it the Biblical Research Institute Committee. And it's formed by approximately 40 Adventist theologians from different parts of the world. They come together with us twice a year. We meet and we, you know, we decide on projects, we decide on issues that have to be addressed by the church, and we assign papers, and the papers are carefully analyzed by that committee. We also go around the world giving seminars and teaching intensive seminary classes to pastors and students of theology. And during the summers, we go out to places like this beautiful place. Oh, I love it. Camp meetings. And we meet with our church members. We like to see that. We want to hear to you, to hear you talking and asking questions. We want to know what is it that worries you, hoping in the future to provide materials that may help to clarify those issues. We, in doing this, I mean, going out to CAN meetings, what we're trying to do is to reaffirm church members on our message and to stimulate Bible study. And that's what we're going to be doing here, stimulating Bible study. Now, you may have not brought your Bible today. That is understandable. And from the standpoint of the teacher today, excusable, not tomorrow.
That's right.
Is that okay with you?
Okay.
So that bringing the Bible here and using it beginning tomorrow will determine 40% of your final grade. and you better pay attention. There's going to be a final test on Friday. Stimulate Bible study. That's what we want. See, we are concerned, the church leaders are concerned about a tendency in our churches to disregard Bible study. In some of our churches, I'm not criticizing, I'm describing the phenomenon. Some of our church members don't even study the Sabbath school quarterly. And we think it's time to bring the church back to the Bible. And it's happening. You know, it's time for us to learn to open the Bible, to listen to it, to understand it, to struggle with it until you understand it. And for that purpose, I selected one of the most difficult books in the Bible. Nobody preaches about it. Perhaps you have heard a sermon about it recently. Have you?
Well, I did, but that doesn't...
Okay, you did well. Now this, the lesson for this week, did you see that? It's about ladies in the Bible. And there is one page on the book of Esther. So a few years ago, I decided to study this book carefully. I was preparing a series of sermons and I decided to use the book of Esther. But then I discovered that the book is difficult. So I decided to write a book on the theology of Esther. And you'll find it there at the ABC. It was published by Andrews University Press, called Esther, A Theological Approach. These are not sermons, it's a theological study. What is it that this book says about God? And why did I get into that? Two reasons. Two important reasons. And they are closely related. The book of Esther gives the impression to the reader that it is a secular book. That it should not be in the Bible. This has been throughout centuries, going back to Jewish traditions, this has been a topic of discussion. What is this book doing in the Bible? First, there's no mention of God in the Bible, in the book. Read the book. The word God is not there. Absolutely no word for God there. There is no mention of prayer. Anything that has to do with religion is not explicitly found there. Nothing. All you have is human activity. Now, it doesn't mean that God is not there. You see what I'm saying? It means that God's presence is silent. You don't see him physically in the book. You don't hear him talking. You know, you read Isaiah and Isaiah says, the word of the Lord, or Ezekiel, the word of the Lord came to me and he said, yeah, you don't find that in Esther. It's not there. Religious language is avoided in the book of Esther. So reading this, I said to myself, you know, this is not too different from what we experience today. Or is it? See, one of the crises that the Christian church in general is facing, and to some extent we as Adventists, one of the crises that we're facing is the divine silence. Now, don't tell me that you have not experienced it in your own life. Because I will not believe you. You see, the Son of God experienced it. Now, we're talking about the Son of God. And there on the cross, the intensity, the pain of that silence was so intense that he did what we all do. He asked the question, why? So don't tell me you have never asked that question. So you have a God who is perceived by humans as being absent. And that's what the book of Esther is about. It's about a God who seems to be absent. Who seems to be quiet in silence. But is he?
No.
No.
Are you just talking to her? Are we allowed to talk back to you?
Yeah, you can talk back to me. This is fine. You can call me Angel.
One of the students in his first grade kept saying teacher.
Yeah, that's okay.
One of the things that I'm wondering about with Esther is if God's action, I mean, the Hebrew people are a subtle people. And I'm wondering if God, I mean, to me, God's actions are clear in here. And I'm wondering if it just was a literary device for God working was so clear, you know, even through Bossy's deposition, you know.
Deposition, it's okay.
And Esther's brought to the, you know, the whole thing. I'm wondering if it was so clear that it was just a subtlety, that they didn't need to mention it because his actions were so very clear.
You see, that's the question. The question she's asking is the absence of the name of God, the absence of religious knowledge in the book, kind of almost an accident, because it's so obvious that he's in charge, that you know, the writer wrote the book, and at the end, he or she, we don't know who, went back and read the book, and he said, oh my, I left out the word God from the book. He said, I don't think so. I think from the very beginning, the biblical writer intentionally decided that he was going to leave out the name God, any reference to God in any way, and that he was going to leave out religious language. I think it's intentional. Let me give you a couple of examples to show you that it was in his or her mind. Let's use her. Is that okay with you? Is that offensive or he? Or if I may use both, so don't you know, feel bad about that. I may use both. Let me give you an example. Okay, let's go to those who have the Bible. Chapter 2, verse 9. You know, this is Esther. She was put under the care of this eunuch. Eunuch. Is that what we say it in here? Eunuch? And what happened according to that verse? The girl was, according to my version here, the girl was good in his eyes and found grace, favor before him. Now, if you go to other places in the Bible, you will find that whenever that is said of one of God's servants, he found grace, favor in the eyes of this one. Whenever that is said, it is always preceded by the idea that God blessed that person. And because of God's blessing, this person found grace. And favor, always. Now, it's not here. It's not there. It was left out. It gives you the impression that Esther was so good that she impressed this servant and found favor. Now, but a very clear case where you have this idea that intentionally the biblical writer is leaving aside religious language is in Esther chapter 4, verse 3. This is when the Jews are going to fast. Remember, now fast is the closest that you get to religious language in Esther. The closest you get to religious language. But in the Bible, practically always, fast was accompanied by prayer. But in Esther, if you read the passage, it says that Esther asked them to fast for me, implying that there was some kind of prayer there, but the biblical writer avoided the term completely, because she was intentionally trying to leave aside explicit religious terminology. Chapter 4, verse 14. This is another case where the biblical writer could have introduced God. No, Esther is undecided on whether she would support or not the suggestion that her uncle brought to her. And he said to her, "Hey, listen, you better do something. Don't even think that you are the exclusive instrument of God. If you don't do anything," then he said, "salvation will come from," from a different place. That would have been a wonderful passage where he could have said, "Listen, if you don't do anything, God is going to bring salvation for his people from some other source." But he or she decided not to do that. Was going to leave out any references to God. And I can go on and give you more examples. You know, you read the book, and in the book, the Jews are called the people of Mordecai. Now, in the Bible, you always read the people of the Lord. First, out. You read about the fear of the Jews. The heathen, many of them, decided not to attack the Jews because of the fear of the Jews. Come on. You go to Chronicles, you know, and in Chronicles you read about people not attacking the Israelites because of the fear of whom? The Lord. You see, he could have added the word there. It was a perfect place, but he decided not to do it. This is what I mean by intentional. He was intentionally trying to keep that religious language away. He was writing what appears to be a secular book. Or is it a secular book? So you do have those evidences, and I would encourage you to go through the book between now and tomorrow. Just read it. It's not a long book. It shouldn't take you too long to read it. Try to find out what is really happening there. And you will find other passages where this element of intentionality is present. Now, do we have evidence in the book that God was indeed active? Of course we do. Let's go over that evidence. Perhaps quickly, depends. Where do you go to get that evidence? You know, how do you do it? You read the story. How are you going to gather that information? Is that information there in the book? How would you gather it? Now, this is what I did. I said to myself, if there is evidence in the book that God was active, it will probably come through the protagonists, the characters in the book. Now, if I look at the characters and try to find out what was inside their heads, that never came out explicit way, but that was inside their head. If I can get inside their heads, then I will know whether the story is a secular one or a religious one. And my conclusion after doing that was that it is a religious one. Now, so I approach the story now from the perspective of the protagonists, the characters. And then I said, let me look at the story as a whole. What is this story trying to achieve? How is the plot developing? And that's what we're going to be doing during the rest of the days. You know, this is narrative, what we call, this is a biblical narrative. And there are many narratives in the Bible. So what I'm going to be sharing with you is how I analyze this narrative, and it may help you when you analyze other biblical narratives, because it helps to open up the biblical text. So I said, well, let me look at the different personalities. You know, let's begin with the king. Now, there's very little about the king in the book. And most people say the king was he wasn't a good man. The king was, in fact, he was not too intelligent. That's what you find in the literature. He was not too intelligent. I found out that he was very clever. You read the story and it gives you the impression that he was emotionally, he was controlled by the emotions. There's a little of that, but he was very careful before making the decisions. So it's very difficult to get inside the mind of the king as you read this story, because there's not much about the king. Not much about the king, you know? But there is an incident in chapter 1, an incident in chapter 1, where you can see a little of the religious dimension coming through. Is it 119? You know what happened? You know the story, you know. Vashti, is that what we call it in English? Vashti say, no, I'm not going down. Sorry, you can call me all the time. You can send soldiers for me. I'm not going down. I'm not going down there to the banquet. I'm not going, period. So he said, oh, this is insubordination. I mean, we cannot handle this. So he brought his advisors. And his advisors were very much concerned. They said, this women's liberation movement has to be stopped. Read the text. That's what it says. You know, if you don't do anything, then we're going to have a revolution here. Ladies are going to get up in arms and they're going to mistreat all men, so we better stop this. Are you telling me that the Bible is not relevant? It's very relevant. So they were concerned about that, very much concerned. Yes.
Well, I appreciate your point, but wasn't Vashti in some ways acting in the role of a very proper Mesopotamian woman, which was not to show herself before a bunch of drunken males? I certainly appreciate that he, especially if I read the history correctly, he was getting ready for a huge battle against the Greeks. He wanted to impress the people that he was supposed to be leading. He didn't want any subordination. But I think in terms of her culture, she was acting in a very conservative fashion.
Well, we have to. We'll come back to Vashti. You know, yes. I think there is an element of integrity on her part. That's what you're talking about, and self-respect that she's defending and willing to sacrifice even her position, her life, for that. So you're right.
Well, I think she was also dependent on her relationship with him, that he would somehow understand her position.
Possibly. That's possibly there. I'm not sure, but there's no doubt that you have a lady here who says, you know, this is humiliating, this is not right, you know. And the advisors say, hey, no, this is not what is happening here. You see, you have to look at this story, and we'll do this again and again. You have to look at the characters and analyze the way they think. And you will see conflicts in the minds of the characters, you know. Vashti may have done it for this reason, but the advisors they're looking at the same phenomenon. This woman who is saying, no, they are looking at this incident from a different perspective. They're thinking in terms of its long-term impact. This will initiate a women's liberation movement. And we're going to have hell in our homes. So we better do something. Now, where is the religious element coming in? The king wants to save her. He does. And he tries to find a law that would allow for that. And what is he told? He's told that the laws, verse 19, the laws of the Persian and Medes cannot be. Where does that idea come from? Do you know where it comes from? It comes from the gods. You read this ancient Near Eastern literature, and again you have the idea that what the gods determine is fixed. It cannot be changed. And what the Medes and Persians did, they took that idea and they defined their laws on the basis of this religious idea. The Medo-Persian laws are unchangeable because they represent, they incarnate in the legal system the divine thoughts. That's what you have there. So that you have, in a very hidden way, you have introduced into the text that the issue here is between the divines, the gods, and their laws that cannot be changed. And some other power that will have to confront that situation. Because this same argument is going to be used later on. You see, this is the first time in the story where this idea is introduced. And if you look at the passage, it is not discussed. The biblical writer introduces the idea and moves on. Later on, you're going to find out that that idea is extremely important. So that he or she is preparing you for what is coming. The legal system was not a secular one, was a religious one also. And you're going to see that later on in the story. So here you have a case where the religious element comes into the story. But it comes in a hidden way. If you read the story quickly, you miss it. If you don't know the background, you miss it. Because that's the way the author wants to write the book. He doesn't want you to know. Now, let's talk about Haman for a few minutes, okay? Haman. Now, Haman is in the book, the enemy. No doubt about that. You know, in almost any story of intrigue, and this is a story of intrigue and suspense, you have the enemy. Now, the good character, you know, you have those, both of them, but Haman is the enemy. Was he a religious man in some way, or was it not? Was he not? And again, it's a little difficult. You read the story. We're going to spend probably tomorrow, or perhaps we may have time to begin today. A little time, we're going to analyze each one of these characters. We're going to take Esther, and we're going to analyze her character. The way her character develops in the story, what is in her mind. And we're going to do the same with Mordecai. And we're going to do the same with Haman. And then you will see them intersecting each other in the story in order to understand really what was going on. Well, You read the story and you read what it says about Haman, and he seems to be really, an evil man. You want an evil character. He is the model. And you want to write a novel, and you want to find, to develop the character of the villain, take Haman. You have all the elements of the villain there. All of them. He models very nicely even Hitler, or Hitler modeled himself after. And at the end, the Antichrist, because Ellen G. White makes the connection. This is not from me, this is from her. She makes the connection there. But is there any evidence in the story that would suggest that this man, Haman, the evil one, was a religious one? You feel free to ask questions and comments, because I told you I don't know everything, so.
This may be not what you're looking for.
No, but that's okay. Throw it in.
Okay, more of a subtle point. But my understanding is that when any country in Mesopotamia went to war, the people were actually replicating the war of the gods.
Yes.
Right? So if someone is defeated, it's as if their god was defeated. Now, if I'm remembering correctly, Haman is an Agagite, which means, I think he's the descendant of somebody that Saul defeated.
Yes, the Amalekites.
Okay. So therefore, his God has been defeated by the children of Israel in some way. And if he is going to bring honor to his God, he must somehow defeat those that defeated his God in the past. And I think he could have looked at it as a holy war, as a Shia.
I think you're right. I think that's the way he looked at it. My question is, where in the book do you have the key that will help you to see that? Because this is a conflict, a religious and civil conflict. So where in the Bible do you find that in the story? And the best place to find it, at least the place where I think it's located, is in chapter, what is it? Is it 3? Yes. You got it. Oh, your people have to be careful with you. Too smart for me. Where is that? You see, he decided to exterminate the Jews. Now, he knew that this was a huge project. And that failure would mean the end of Haman. He knew that very well. So he decided to coordinate all the elements very carefully to make sure that he was going to be successful. Very carefully. Now, the first thing he did, he decided to cast the lot. How do you call it? Yeah, the lot, isn't it? Yeah. Now, this was a very common practice. And you find it in the Bible. It was based on the belief that the gods could influence an object with the intention of communicating his will. It was a religious practice. Now, there's nothing religious there. If you read the passages, there is absolutely no reference to the divine. It simply says that he what? Let me see. We're talking about what? Which verse?
7.
In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan. Now, that's important. Which month? The first month of the year. They cast the lot. In Hebrew, is called Pur. In fact, this is not Hebrew. This is, well, it's Hebrew, but Hebrew language has a different term for that. This is a Persian term. The lot. And what was the intention? To select a day and a month. And they tells you which day was selected. Why is he doing this? He was aligning the gods. He wants them to be with him. See, this is religious coming in. He was a religious man. In quotes, you know, religious, you know. It was the belief based on ancient mythology. Let's begin there. Ancient mythology. At the beginnings, according to Babylonian mythology and Medo-Persian mythology, at the beginning, the gods fixed the fates of everything. Creation was fixing the fate of everything. You know, the tree is going to do this. This tree is apple tree. This is what is going, so I'm going to fix that. And animals, the horse is going to be this way, and the fate of the horse is fixed. And this divine activity in primeval times was reenacted in ancient mythology at the beginning of every year. At the beginning of every year, according to this mythology, the gods got together and they determined the fate of everything for that year and every person for that year. And that took place during the first month of a year. What did it say there? That Haman went the first month of the year. He knows that the gods are determining the fates of people, and he wants to put in their agenda their own agenda. Ah, he's coordinating with the gods to make sure that the gods will place in their calendar this event, and he wants to know the dates he placed there. They placed there. So he cast the lots, believing that the gods were going to influence the lots. Now, we are not sure how lots were cast in the ancient world. If you look at the terminology that the Bible uses and the terminology used in ancient Eastern literature, it is clear that something was put inside some kind of a bowl with a large neck spout. Is that what we call it? Spout. And it was shaken, and one piece came out, and then the other, and the other. That's probably one of the ways they did, or perhaps some scholars have suggested that there was an image of the god. And the lots, which were usually stone with some inscription, written something there, the name of the month, for instance, the day of the name of the month or the day of the week, and they were thrown before the image of the god, and the one that was closer to the image was the one selected. That's why it says that he kept on casting the lot, because he had to select several things, and that's the way he decided that this is going to happen this month and in the 13th. That's why we got this Friday the 13th thing, you know, I suppose. So you do have here a person who has some religious convictions and who believes that the gods are there and that he could influence them in order to gain their support for the plan he has in his head. So you have religious ideas coming into the story slowly, but nevertheless, in a very effective way. So I would argue, and I have argued in the book, that Haman was a religious man. That is to say, he believed that there were gods, and that those gods had the power to influence and determine whatever took place in the arena of human history. And that he, could influence the behavior of the gods in human history in order to accomplish his own purpose. Now, this is ancient Near Eastern religious convictions. Somehow the ancient people believed that they could influence their gods. In the ancient Near East, sacrifices were offered. But you know, the sacrifices had not the same purpose that they have in the Bible. The sacrifices were food for the gods, because the gods were conceived as having needs. So they had to be fed, and the people had to feed them. And as long as they provided the gods with what they needed, then they could go back to the gods and say, well, you know, I did this for you, now you better do this for me. So they influenced the divine in order to accomplish their own purpose. That's what you have here. That's exactly what Haman was doing, trying to influence the gods in order to accomplish whatever he wanted to accomplish. Let's take Mordecai. Now, we're going to look at Haman later on much more carefully. How he's introducing this story, how his character develops, and what happens to him, and all of that. What went on in his mind. But for now, what we're trying to show is the religious element coming in. Mordecai. Was Mordecai a religious man or not? Is there, of course, we know he was, because he was a Jew, you know. And to say you are a Jew meant, hey, he worshiped the Lord. So that is a given. But the question is whether in this story he is depicted as a religious person or not. That's the question. Because the biblical writer is trying to avoid religious language. So, in this story, is he represented as a religious man? Now, let me ask you a question. Is there air conditioning here or not?
No.
We might be able to get fans. Okay. That's fine. That's a clear answer. There's no ambiguity. Nobody's trying to hide anything there. There's no air conditioning. Mordecai, was he a religious man? Of course he was. Yet the biblical writer doesn't state it explicitly. Doesn't. But the best passage is chapter 3, verse... Well, it's not the best, but one of them. 3-2. You know, you have... The king had order that everybody had to acknowledge Haman as the second man in the kingdom. And whenever he came to the palace, everybody had to do homage to him. And then the Bible says here that there was a man there by the door, verse 2, all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. And the friends, you know, at first, Haman doesn't notice this. But the other people there see it, and they said to him, you know, some of them were friends of Mordecai. I said to him, listen, I know what you're doing. I've seen you. When he comes in, you go and you stand behind one of the pillars. And that's not good. If he noticed that, you're going to be in trouble. And you read the story, and he said, the story says that Haman did not do it because he was a Jew. Now, doing, you know, honor to a human being, there's nothing wrong with that in the Bible. You find people, you know, bowing down to kings and to prophets. There's nothing wrong with that. But Mordecai is reading this as a violation of his religious conviction. It's the only way you can understand why he was doing this. If you check in the Hebrew Bible, the places where those two verbs are used, did you notice there are two verbs? To kneel down and to pay or give honor. And most Bibles say what? Kneel and prostrate or whatever. If you look for passages in the Hebrew Bible where those two verbs are used together, there are not too many of those biblical passages. There are probably four. And in all of them, the people are kneeling down, doing homage to God. All of them. Now, in some other passages, you have only kneeling down, and that could be before a human being, or you have honoring somebody. But the two together in the Hebrew Bible are always used to refer to what you do before God. And that's the way Mordecai is interpreting this. Of course, the king, again, you have a conflict of perspectives here. The king was not asking people to worship Haman. That was not in the head of the king. You see what I mean? So the perspective, from the perspective of the king, that's not what he has in mind. But from the perspective of Mordecai, he looks at the command from a different perspective. He says, no, I cannot do that. That we Jews, we do that before our God. We cannot do it to him. Sorry, I'm a Jew. So you do have this religious dimension coming in immediately. The next place where we find religious ideas coming in is in chapter 4, I think it is.
Yes.
Is that right?
Verse 12
through 14. Is that right? Let's go there. I'm in the wrong chapter. Mordecai is trying to persuade Esther to do something. And then he says, for if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from some other place or from another place. But if you have to read, you know, even the rest of the verse, and who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. What do you have there? See, this is non-religious language, but the ideas are religious ideas. What is he really telling her? He's telling her, listen carefully, Esther. I believe that there is a God who leads our lives. And I always wonder why you became queen. Always. No, my little girl became a queen. And I always said, you know, it's amazing. My little girl, a Jewish girl, became... I always wonder about that. But I want you to know that today I think I know. It seems to me that the Lord selected you to be a queen for a time like this. See, he believes that there is a divine power that is leading history to some particular end. And that divine power also leads the life of individuals. And that we all are here for some particular reason. So he says to her, you know, your life has a particular goal, what the Greeks called a telos, a goal. Your life has a goal. And don't think that you are going to reach that goal by not getting involved. If you don't get involved, your life will come to an end. Or you're not going to escape. Don't think that the other Jews are going to die and you are going to escape. Huh? It is my conviction, he said, that it is probably for this purpose that you became queen. This passive form of verbs there. He doesn't say, you became queen for this. No. Because his God is not like Haman's gods. Haman could influence their gods, you know, and get from them what he wanted. But in the case of Esther, he says, no, my God, I'm not sure what is his plan for you, but it may well be that this is why you're here. And if you don't do anything, he will find some other source of help. Because my God does not depend exclusively on one instrument. That's true, my good friends. Isn't that good? My. He always has plan B. Plan B. Always. And probably C. So he's telling her, you know, he has a plan B if you fail him. But he brought you here for some purpose, yes. Yes.
And was outside the gates when she was in there, and you know, she hadn't seen a king for 30 days, so probably the man in her life who had her love and respect for Mordecai, and they were very close, and he just like a code to her, and
Well, yes, that because of that, as you're saying, because of that closeness and respect, is that she feels free, that he feels free to approach her. But you will see later on how Esther herself and her role in the story and her character develops in the story. It's impressive. But you do have that. This man, she respects, so he talks to her heart. And he has this no doubt. Without using religious language, the biblical writer is telling us that Mordecai believed that history is under the control of a divine power, and that he wants to use instruments to accomplish his purpose. And we have to be willing to let that transcendental power use us. Let's take Esther briefly. Was she a religious lady or not? Again, you know, of course she was Jewish, so she was religious, but the question is whether in the story she is represented as a religious person or not. She never uses the name God. It is never said that she prayed. Was she in the story depicted as religious? Of course she is. It seems to me, in a very veiled way, because the emphasis is on the silence of God. The painful silence of God. That's what the story is about. So was she a religious person or wasn't she? And probably the best passage is here, 4, where we were, verse 16. Finally, Esther says, okay, that's fine. I'll follow your advice. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my maids will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. This is a powerful passage. I mean, when you read this passage over against what Haman did, it becomes even more meaningful. She's telling them, go and fast. Now, in the Bible, fasting, there were different types of fasting. And most fasting in the Bible is day fasting. It's like what the Arabs do during Ramadan, you know. They fast for a whole month, I think it is. But that doesn't mean that they are not eating. It means that they fast during the day hours. And then when the night comes, they have supper. A good supper. And that's understandable. I'm not, you know, not criticizing that. I would probably do the same thing. And this was the practice throughout the ancient Near East, and that was the practice in biblical times. There are passages where you find this idea. But there were also fasts that included the night. Very intense fast. That's what she's asking for, you know. And you notice that it's not a long fast, because if you're not going to drink water, then you better make a short fast, because after 3 days you're going down, literally down. So the Bible is very careful with that. In fact, fasting in the Bible allowed drinking water because of the hot weather. What you find in the Bible most of the time is fasting, not eating food. And when water was excluded, it was immediately mentioned, food or water.
Does this drink imply that water?
Apparently not, because the text explicitly says no food or drinking.
Or drink.
Drink. Yeah. It will be water, yes. So it's a very tough task. I mean, you know. What type of fast is this? This is a religious fast. How do we know? Because of the little phrase there. Did you notice that phrase? She says, fast for me. And that preposition, for, it's a Hebrew preposition, al, and it means on my behalf. On my behalf. So you go and fast on my behalf. So there's somebody to whom they are offering the fast. And who's going to do something for her. She believes that there is someone who could help her. He believes that. You go and talk to him. You know, offer this fast. In the Bible, fasting is a very important religious practice. It isn't that common these days, you know. As a religious practice, as a dietary practice, it's very common, you know. My daughters used to fast every week, day or two. Non-religious. Just wanted to get rid of a couple of pounds here and there. And that's very common in our society. But religious fasting is not that common even among Adventists. But in the Bible it was. And it's a very strange religious practice, because God commanded us to eat. He created us, and then he said to us, listen, this is what we're going to do. Created you, this is what we're going to do. We're going to share the responsibility for the preservation of your life. I created you. It's not your life, but we're going to share the responsibility to preserve your life. And this is what we're going to do in Genesis 1, chapter 2. You are going to eat this and this and this. That's how you're going to cooperate with me preserving life. So that, according to Genesis, changing the diet, eating what he didn't want us to eat, was an act of rebellion. Or saying, I'm not going to eat, was an act of rebellion. I'm not going to cooperate with you. But when it comes to fast, that's exactly what is happening. The believers are saying to the Lord, we are not going to cooperate with you. We're going through such a difficult and painful experience that we want you to know that if we're going to be preserved, it would have to be by you. We're going to rely totally on you. If you do not do anything, we're going to die. See, Lord, how committed we are to you. So this is an external ritual act using the body to express an inner, invisible commitment to God. Are you with me? You see, we don't think in those terms. In the Western world, we believe that emotions and ideas and convictions are inside. And you go to churches and people tell you, I'm so happy today. You know, and they are happy. But what happens? The body doesn't reflect it because it's an emotion. You can have it inside, you know, not in the biblical time. In the biblical time, you were happy, you will shout and sing to the Lord, you see? And you will show it on your face. If you want to show that you are absolutely, totally committed to the Lord because you're going through this problem and you have come to the conclusion that the only one who can help you with this is Him, you are going to manifest that through a fast, physical. That could be, but in Western society, physical expressions of affection or joy are, you know, don't touch me too much when we talk, you know. We Hispanics, we touch people when we talk. I have to control myself, you know, when I talk to Americans. Because when I go to Europe, because we talk and we say, how are you doing today? You see, we cannot avoid it. It's not enough saying, how are you doing? We have to touch the person. Or we're talking with somebody and we say, hey, buddy, how are you doing? And we hug each other. When we're so happy to see a friend and we hug each other, you know. Now, in the ancient world, that was done much more. Even today, you go to Israel and you find the Arabs, men, walking, holding hands. Two men. Now, you don't want... You see that in an American. Or you see them, you know, walking. Well, how do you say it? With the arm around. You see these Arabs. And they are talking and they are enjoying life. And you know that this is... This physical element, you have a nice feeling toward a friend, you touch them, you touch them with the smiles and with the hands. You know, this is the way they express, we don't do that. Touch me, don't touch me. You know, we love you, I'm so happy with the Lord, but the body, it doesn't get involved as much. It's impossible not to be involved, you know, the body gets involved, but not as much. But in the ancient world, it was. And so the fasting was the participation of the body in our inner commitment to God. It was not something that happened in my mind. My spirit is committed to the Lord, the body, no. This is the biblical understanding of a human being as a unity. And if you are committed to the Lord, your body will show it. So I'm in this situation. It's very difficult. I have realized that I have limits, that there is nothing I can do to deal with this situation. I trust that the Lord will have to do something. That's all in my head. I tell Him, I pray to Him, and I say, Lord, you have to help me. Well, for the ancients, that was not enough. They will show that inner attitude in a physical experience of fasting.
This idea of fasting without water for 3 days.
Dangerous.
It comes to me as a real... I just always assume that the drink would be a juice of some kind. But just so everybody knows, I don't know if everybody realizes, 3 days for an average person without any intake of water.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Death.
Now, you keep in mind that in the Hebrew Bible, 3 days is today, tomorrow, and then the third day is when you finish. So it are not 24 hours days, but a shorter period. But nevertheless, your point is right. It's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's why in the Bible, whenever you hear about fasting without food and water, it's never more than 3 days. Except You see, the Bible always has exceptions. Moses and Jesus. And in those cases, you have to acknowledge that they were sustained directly by God. There's no other way to explain it. So you do have in this passage the expression of a religious conviction in non-religious language. I'm talking about Esther, no? The expression of a religious conviction in non-religious language, because the biblical writer wants, what is it that he wants? He wants you to feel the silence. The silence. The silence of God. Now notice that the last part of that verse, what is it, 7:16? I will go to the king even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. So what is he saying? Now you talk to him, to the big one, about this. You tell him that there is no way out of this. There's nothing we can do. He has to intervene to help me. Yet I'm going to also, at the same time, I'm going to affirm that it doesn't matter how much you fast, you're not going to change his mind. You're going only to express your desire. Now, this is not what Haman had in mind when he went to the gods. He wanted to commit the gods to his plan to make sure that his plan was successful. So he did something to influence them, to twist their arms so that he can accomplish what he wanted. Esther is saying, my God is different. We can fast all we want. He will always remain what? Free. But there's one thing that I will do. You fast, I go to the king. Now, if it doesn't coincide with the will of God, that's fine with me. If I have to perish, I'm ready to perish. You see the difference? Did you capture the idea? When she says, if I perish, I perish, she was testifying about divine freedom. I may have to die. His plan may be different. But I'm willing to do what I can to become his instrument. So I do not control him. Neither do you, Jews. Just go and do what you have to do. Express to him your dependence. But remember, he remains always free. Man, we better believe that. Amen. We would like to manipulate him. And I don't blame you, and I don't even blame myself, because I've been there. And there have been times when I would have lied for him to do exactly what I wanted. And sometimes he, in his grace, did it. Not always. Sometimes silence is what I get. Silence. And silence is beautiful.
I wonder how long it took her to decide that course of action, because that would be something I would have to pray about a long time and make sure that I'm doing, rather than just coming out and saying, okay, I'm going to do this and hopefully God's going to back me up.
Yeah. Your question is a good one, and the text doesn't say. It may have taken her some time. I'm sorry?
Before she stepped out
of faith. Or perhaps she simply said, yes, I'm going to do it. That's a possibility. But there is no doubt that Mardukai had to try to persuade her. So there was an initial reluctance on her part. It's the reluctance of people who are in a position where they feel safe. And why risking my safety? It's a logical human reaction, you know? Logical human reaction. So there was an element of persuasion there. And I can imagine the struggle in her mind. Even if it was an immediate reaction, there was still the struggle. If it took a little longer, there was a struggle in her mind. But she finally decided to cast her lot with the Lord. And therefore the religious idea comes through without religious language.
But then again, she was raised by her uncle, and she was raised, and he was a very religious man, I think.
Yes.
This is my impression of Esther. And she had a lot of faith, I think, because of the way she was raised.
You're right. There's another last, this last question, and then we'll go.
And also the fact that, like, a Jew that's been in captivity for a while, and as Christians today, you're tending to feel comfortable with this world, saying, okay, I know that Jesus is coming, but I have my work, I have my job, I have friends, kind of thing. So we need also to be reminded,
yes,
that we are here for God.
Yeah. And that we have to cooperate with his plan. But it's interesting, you know, for us as parents to think that the seed that was planted finally produced fruits. Come back tomorrow, but read the story between now and tomorrow so that we can interact a little more.
This special presentation has been brought to you by American Cassette Ministries. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2001, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes by this speaker or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please contact us as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 1-800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 1-717-652-9050. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. Our entire current catalog plus many other items are available online from our secure website, www.americancassette.org. We accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover cards. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108 in the United States of America. Answering the heart cry of the faithful for 26 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry, to prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.